In chapter 13, we get to some practical things. Now, from chapter 11 to 12, it was a transition from the theology to the practical application, from creed to conduct, from what we would say our doctrine to our duty as Christians. And chapter 13, particularly, even more, where chapter 12 was like running the race, now we get to chapter 13 and there's a whole bunch of little exhortations, little encouragements. In the practical life, we're going to look at love here and marriage next time. Then contentment and submission to authority, stability, benevolence, prayer, all kinds of subjects that pertain to our lives in the meantime where we're here. But let's tie this in as a foundation that he lays leading us up into this and back up to verse 28 for a moment, chapter 12. He says, "Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire." Now, we talked about that last time. Since we are receiving a kingdom. Now, we noted that we have come to Mount Zion, past tense. That is, we've already experienced a taste of the kingdom. But then there's also the idea of the kingdom coming. We have tasted the kingdom because the Holy Spirit of God has brought the kingdom in our hearts when we yielded to Jesus, His authority as the Son of God, believed on Him, we became born again, and the kingdom of God came within our hearts. However, we know that we're awaiting a real kingdom where Jesus comes on the earth. And as we watch the news around us, know that, well, we're getting closer and closer to the time the Lord is going to deal with this ungodly world, and the age of grace will come to an end, judgment will come out, and then the Lord will come back and reign on this earth for 1,000 years. And we will reign with Him, those who have believed in Him. Now, since we're receiving such a kingdom, notice that cannot be shaken. I love that right there because we have seen many kingdoms come and go, many empires. And they all thought that they were the last word. Babylon thought it was the last word. Rome thought it was the last word and bring in the utopian society. Many dictators have thought they're going to bring a utopian society to this world. But it's not until the Prince of Peace comes that that will happen. But that is a kingdom that is unshakable. And I hope that when you think about where you are with your Maker, your God, if there's any business you have to attend to with Him, that is to deal with your sin by receiving the Lord, you do that to be a part of that kingdom that's coming. But He's speaking to those who have received and will look forward to receiving that kingdom which cannot be shaken. He says this. This is our response in the meantime. Let us have grace by which we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Essentially, that's what I consider the missing element today in many places in the church. There seems to be a getting away of that reverence and godly fear more to a casual, you know, hey, whatever makes you feel good approach to God. Kind of the emerging church mentality, you know, kind of like we can pick and choose what we like, what we don't like, we'll leave out, and we'll create our own experience with God. Instead, this is how we are to respond to this promise of the coming kingdom, to serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. There's a lack of awe today, a lack of being impressed by the power and the majesty of God, and, well, we need to have a greater vision of Him. Isaiah, when he had the vision of Him in Isaiah 6, he saw the cherubim singing, "Holy, holy, holy," around the throne. When that whole vision appeared to him, what did he do? He fell on his face. And he cried out, "Woe is me, I am undone." See, when there is a sense of the reverence of God, an awareness of who He is, literally reverence means blushing. It's like we're conscious of our own incompleteness. We see Him holy, complete, unique, and we are incomplete. And we're conscious of that. We wouldn't be conscious of that unless we had a bigger vision of God. But instead, people want to rashly approach God as if they've got everything it takes, not coming through the gate which the Lord established through His own Son, not coming with that humility and thankfulness for what He has done. So here's the irony, though. When you come to the Lord with godly fear, when you come broken with a contrite heart, He lifts up your head and He strengthens you and encourages you and gives you a sense of boldness and confidence in Him. Others might mistake that as self-confidence, but I can assure you it's not. There's a big difference. See, when you look at a life of a Christian who is walking in godly fear to the Lord, they're in reverence to the Lord, they're encouraged because of His sacrifice for them. They walk with that sense of confidence among others, and others think, oh, wow, they're pretty self-confident. No, it's really not self-confidence. It's confidence because the Bible says the righteous are bold as lions. You don't have to fear what men may do to you. You're not concerned about that. So now you are complete in Him. And now we come to this final picture, this final chapter. And the top priority we see, the outcome of this serving God with reverence and godly fear really is now, I love this, listen, very down to earth. This wonderful, glorious experience with God and recognizing the kingdom is coming and we're with Him and we serve Him with godly fear. How do we do it? Well, let brotherly love continue. You know, I love this. It's a top priority in our life. Peter speaks about adding to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness love. That is the top priority. Generally speaking, the fruit of the Spirit, what is it? The fruit of the Spirit is love. And I know you want to keep going on that. And sometimes we make the mistake of thinking of it as the fruits of the Spirit are. No, it's the fruit of the Spirit is love. Well, what's joy? Peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. We teach our children, you know, even in our children's church, the 9 fruits of the Spirit. Really, there's one fruit. It's love, but it's manifested in all those things. Love is the thing that internally convinces you, proves to you, that something has changed within you. John, in his epistle, in 1 John 3:14, says, "We know that we've passed out of death into life because we love the brethren." How do we know? Because there is love now. That's the thing that stuck out in my heart when I came to the Lord. I knew something changed in me. I couldn't figure out what was different until I began to realize I care for people. I want others to experience that joy I have now. I love. But it's also the external proof that you're God's. Jesus told His disciples, "By this all will know that you're My disciples, if you have love for one another." By this it will be seen. They will know. So this gives an outward proof. It also gives an inward proof of where we stand with the Lord. Now, that's generally speaking love, and that's essentially the word agape. Now, agape is the foundation. We've talked about this before. Agape is that love in which when you say, "I do," at the altar in a marriage, you're committing yourself. No matter how you feel, through sickness or health, adversity, prosperity, rich or poor, whatever it is, you're saying, "Till death do us part, I am committed." That, folks, is what love is. God loved us that way. He was committing Himself to us by sending His Son to die for us. In fact, the cross really shows us 2 very important things. It shows us, number one, how bad off we were, how bad our sin was. Most people would have no clue how bad their sin is. They would think, "Well, I'm comparing myself with others. I'm not so bad." It's because you're comparing the wrong thing. You're compared to a holy God. You're in bad shape. So that's why He had to send His own Son to die on the cross. Look what it cost Him. That should tell you how bad sin is. Look what it cost Him to forgive you. But the cross also shows us the love of God, how much He loved us to send His only Son to the cross to die in our place. So His love was commitment. That's the foundation. But you build on that foundation. This love that He speaks about, let brotherly love, is one word in Greek, brotherly love. It's Philadelphia, the Greek word Philadelphia. We get our city named after that Greek word, the city of brotherly love. Brotherly love, this is phileo. This is the friendship love. But don't underestimate it. I think sometimes people think, well, agape is the pinnacle and phileo is kind of a friendship love. Do you know, switch that around. Not that agape is less, but agape is the foundation of which you build this more significant love with God and with others that is very down to earth. And it's a give and take. It's a friendship. Now, this is a family bond. This kind of love has to be worked out in practical ways to show thoughtfulness, kindness, help, encouragement, thinking of others. In order to have friends, what do you have to be? Friendly, right? So you have to work at friendship. Commitment love is there. It's committed. God is committed to us. But now actually wanting us to work that out in that yieldedness to Him, that give and take, that friendship with Him. The same thing with each other. Let brotherly love continue. You know, this is also where the internet church breaks down. People who live in the internet church, they find their speakers on the internet, they get on the chat rooms, their whole experience is on the internet when it comes to church. I'll tell you right now what the missing element is. They can't practice brotherly love. They can't experience the difficulties and the challenges it is to get along with people, to work out disagreements, to work through issues, to die to yourself and to live for someone else and see someone in need and sacrifice to help that need. This, folks, is what brotherly love is all about. Can't do it on the internet. If you're watching on the internet, talking to you right now. Now, if you can't be here, I understand that. If you're sick, that's why we're there. If you're out in the outskirts and you have no other place right now, in the meantime, that's why you're there and we're blessed to provide that. But if you're just around the corner watching the internet, you better get off the couch. Get down here for third service. Let brotherly love continue. Now, why does he say continue? Well, first of all, we know that because he's encouraging them, they do have it. And you have it. You have some. There's some brotherly love in every one of you to a certain degree, but the idea is to continue it. Beyond just having it, it presupposes that you have it, but you now need to practice it. But here's the challenge. The fact that he says let it continue also should tell you something very important, that it's going to be difficult. It's not just going to happen automatically. It's not going to be like you're going to walk in here, you're going to get hit with one of those spiritual cherubs, you know, with the arrow, and all of a sudden you're going to be like, oh, I love God. Oh, I love people. Oh, we all love. Oh, this is wonderful. No, it's actually getting down to the nitty-gritty of putting up with each other in some ways. It's overlooking a multitude of sins. It's dealing with situations that are difficult and misunderstandings and challenges. And you know what? This whole love toward others really needs to come. This horizontal can only come from the vertical. In fact, the Ten Commandments, if you think of it, Jesus said it all sums up in two commandments, love God and love your neighbor, right? Loving God is the vertical. Having that straight will also straighten all of your relationships with people. But if your relationship with God is off kilter, your relationships with others are going to be off kilter. We have to understand that this loving, let brotherly love continue comes as a result of the grace of the Lord shown to us. The experience we have with God. Now, how important was this brotherly love, especially to those he was writing to? In the Roman culture, it became increasingly difficult to walk as a Christian. You were counted as a Jewish sect. The Jews were thrown out of Rome at one point. The persecution was huge. Christians were just another Jewish sect to the Romans, so they were persecuted as well. The church had to go underground. It was persecuted both by the Romans and as well as the Jewish people that did not acknowledge Jesus as Messiah. So it was a very difficult time. To show brotherly love, to risk your safety, your property, your family, your life to help someone else was a very costly, expensive experience that you might have to undergo. So it was a risk. You know, we have to also understand sin has engineered a reaction against this. We have to be ever vigilant in keeping the weeds of sin and selfishness from taking root. Once that seed of love has been planted, Satan wants to plant some other things as well. Which should also tell us, you see, by definition, love is expressed in the little things. Love is patient, love is kind, and also what love is not. Love is not boastful, not proud, not envious. See, love is the antithesis to self being on the throne. And this is where the challenge lies. When he says, let brotherly love continue, he knows, he presupposes a battle ahead. More than you expect. Here's what happens. You come to church. You come and gather with people who are professing the name of Christ. And understand that, well, the Italian-American club down the way, or the various lodges, the various social clubs out there, that people gather because there's a certain camaraderie, a certain identification with each other in this community, They have issues to work through, but they don't have one thing that you have. That is a spiritual enemy determined to break up this spiritual love that you have for one another. Why is he so determined to break that up? Why does the enemy of our soul want us to stumble in this area? Why we need to be exhorted to let brotherly love continue? It's because the very fact that it encourages you, that you know that you're now in the Lord's camp when you have that love, it gives you assurance, and it also is a testimony to the world that there is a God among you, that God is real, and he changes hearts. So if he can stop this brotherly love, if he can sow discord, if he can throw a wrench into the system, then it'll keep his kingdom of darkness going quite well, thank you. You see, we shouldn't be surprised, in other words. A lot of you come in with these expectations of a church. Oh, you people are supposed to be wonderful, nice, loving, kind. And with those expectations high, you fail to understand, yes, they should be high. We should have a higher standard. But also we have that enemy that's going to try to sow misunderstandings, sow discord, sow issues, make you major on the minors, to nurse your hurts and to accentuate your needs. And people aren't meeting your needs and no one reaches out to you and no one's caring about you. See, this is the plot. This is the strategy. You've got to be aware of that. That's why he tells us to let brotherly love continue. If it was going to come automatically, he wouldn't have to exhort us, would he? No, it gets down to the nitty gritty. You know, we need this exhortation because Satan is trying to stop this Christian love. And you know what? There might even be around you some whisperers that are they're eager to give you information about others, give you some dirt on someone else. Let me tell you about so-and-so. Oh, really? You know, let me tell you something. That is so like someone who's being used of Satan to sow discord, to sow challenges and questions. You know, well, you know, those people have issues. You don't go over there. Well, Pastor Lloyd says this and does that. And, you know, and people will talk. Instead of really building up the body, they're tearing it down. Anyone can tear it down. They can undermine people. They can ruin reputations. They can sow lies and deceit. They pretend like they're in the know and they really know what's going on around here. And I'll tell you what, be careful. Will Rogers once said this. He said, "We have to so order our lips that we would not be afraid to sell the family parrot to the pastor." I like that. That our lips are so ordered by the Lord that even at home, when we speak very frankly, we're very careful about another person's reputation. We're very careful how we speak about people, how we consider them. You know, in fact, in a very practical way, George Whitefield and Charles Wesley, John and Charles Wesley, they actually worked together in the revival in the 1700s. Tremendous ministry that the Lord gave all of them. But they were in different theological camps. They didn't agree on a doctrine that you've got the Arminian doctrine, you've got the Calvinist doctrine. They weren't in agreement on those things. And they were important doctrines, but at the same time, when they saw God moving among the people in this nation, and the gospel's going forth and people responding, there seemed to be this amazing revival. They had to work through those challenges. Now, it wasn't easy. They were very passionate about how they viewed the scriptures. And they would dispute with one another. And they would argue over these things. But at one point or another, they made up their mind to not let that dissuade them from working together. In fact, George Whitefield wrote this to John Wesley. He says, "Why should we dispute when there is no possibility of convincing? I'm not going to convince you. You're not going to convince me. Why do we keep disputing about this? Will it not," he says, "in the end, destroy brotherly love and take from us that sweetness of soul where I pray God may always subside between us?" You know, that is good counsel. Because that can happen in any type of this denominational sectarian spirit. Like, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos. Well, I'm of Calvary Chapel. I would hate for anybody to walk out here with this attitude like, "We're at Calvary Chapel. We're where things are really moving, where God is due." You know, you hear that sometimes, you know, maybe not in so many words, but there's that little bit of arrogance and pride that I'm blessed that you're excited about this church, but I would certainly want you to know that God has his people in many other places. God has many other denominations out there that are holding the line. Now, even if you see in the news about certain denominations, you know, losing ground to liberal thinking in the Bible and not even having a foundation and they're even believing the Bible anymore, I can tell you that there are godly people in every one of those denominations. The last 8 months, I've met people from Episcopalian church that are holding the line against the liberal side, and they're really wanting the Lord to be honored. I met some godly people from the Lutheran church, from the Methodist church, from Baptists and Pentecostals. God has his people from all. Those differences that we share, really, folks, are oftentimes minor issues. Even when they're important differences, nothing is as important as the simple message of the gospel, what God has done through his Son. Because ultimately, that should be a unified message from the church, his people in all these different denominations, to the world. They can have salvation through the Lord Jesus Christ. So we have to be careful about this mentality. Now, continue implies we have to be on our guard continuously, be vigilant, to fertilize, to weed, to water this love, because it doesn't just happen. It's a very insidious killer, this self-love. In fact, self-love is the antithesis to true brotherly love. When you think about yourself first, it's going to be very hard for you to be thoughtful of another. In fact, I sometimes get a little annoyed at the psychobabble that I hear from time to time, even from Christians. Well, you got to love yourself first before you can love others. To many, a lack of self-esteem is the real problem. But let me say this. In reality, do you know you would really lose respect for yourself when you behave selfishly? You'll feel that guilt, that shame. Self-loathing is often a product of selfish and sinful living. Then you're going to be disgusted with yourself. You see, by nature, we want the best for ourselves. And if we're interested in what makes us feel good, let me give you the answer for that. The way God made you, the only way you're truly going to feel good about yourself is not being a self-centered slob. Not thinking of yourself first, but helping others. That's what makes you feel better. That's what is going to give you a good self-image, if you will. Is yourself is not on the throne anymore. Others. You're thinking of others first. And it's very tragic to me. All the natural gifts that God might give to you, the abilities and personality, that someone could prostitute that for themselves. And thus they will miss out for themselves in what true love is. And they certainly won't be a benefit or a blessing to anybody else either. The greatest cure in this area for self is serving. Jesus modeled that for us. Now, here's how it works in a practical way. When he says, let brotherly love continue, we know by implication it's going to be a challenge. It's not going to come easy. Use marriage, for example. You know, we think about marriage itself. Initially, you think, oh, how wonderful it's going to be. Then you get married, and after a few weeks, you learn some annoying habits of your mate. You know, they put their best foot forward all during the engagement period, right? And now you're waking up next to dragon breath, and not that my wife was that. I'm just using this as an illustration. Just want to make sure everybody knows that I'm talking in generalizations here. But you learn, you know, you see each other's weaknesses. You see each other's difficult side. And you know, that's why you make a commitment before you get into that marriage, because it's going to be some challenges ahead. Here's what happens. This is what happens in a very selfish society. At some point, one or the other decides, you know what, this is just too much work. I keep giving and giving and giving. I'm. What about me? I deserve to be happy. I don't like this. You know, they don't understand me. Don't care, but I'm going to do my own thing. Well, at some point or another, you stop trying. You say, I've given this much, I'm not going to give anymore. Well, at that point, your marriage is dying. At that point, when you decide, this is as far as I'm going to go, I'm not going to change anymore, and you hear this, you've got to accept me the way I am. Well, you know, what if your five-year-old said, Ma, Dad, you got to accept me the way I am right now, so I'm not going to change. Really? Don't you want to continue to grow and mature as an individual? I'm growing every day. The time you stop growing, you're going to die. You have no more appetite for the things of God and to honor him, then you're already starting down the wrong path. So here's the thing, though. Because it's a chore to love, brotherly love, building that friendship, give and take, compromising with each other, thinking of others first, when it's a chore, we decide somewhere along the line it's not worth it, or We commit ourselves to do it anyway. Now here's the amazing thing. A selfish person will arrive at this conclusion. It's not worth it. It's not worth all the work I have to put into this thing. I'm not getting enough out of this. It's not worth it. I give up. But a person who's made a commitment and he's not thinking of himself first is going to continue through those chores. He's going to continue to do that which is hard to do. Deny himself, be patient, put up with the idiosyncrasies of someone. See, because you know what, guys, think about it. As a guy, you know, you get together with the guys in the locker room. Hey, Stinky, how you doing? Hey, what's going on with you? You don't even think about the words you use. You're not going to hurt anybody's feelings. You just let it all fly, right? But you're not going to say to your wife, hey, Stinky. Doesn't work that way. You've got to think of what you say. You've got to be wise in how you approach her. You've got to be patient. You've got to be sensitive. And it's so unlike you as a man, isn't it? For the most part, generally speaking, you know, you have to learn this stuff. So a man gets married in the first year of marriage. It's like he's got this shock all of a sudden come to him. Man, this is going to be hard. I got to, like, man, saying the wrong things every other day. Why is she so sensitive? What's up with that? You know, and you go complain to your friends. I can't believe her, you know. Well, welcome to what marriage is. It's about learning how to adjust to each other. It's true in friendship. You learn how to adjust to each other. It's true in your commitment and relationships. You learn how to adjust, and it's a chore at first. But here's the good news. When you continue to do your chores, if you will, something happens in you. Something changes in you. And the Lord knows it. He knows that when you make up your mind to do the right thing, you're going to have all hell break loose to attack you. But as you keep fortifying yourself against those attacks, keep doing the right thing, keep doing the right thing, eventually what happens is your heart changes. You break through a certain point. And now you actually get a greater delight out of pleasing that other person more than you do in when they're pleasing you. There's certain things I know my wife loves to do. She loves to go for walks. I hate walking. I can't say I've really actually gotten into it because now my knee's dead and so I can't walk with her very far anyway. But I know when she's out there, it's kind of a cool thing to sneak up on her. Maybe I'll have my bike though, but I'll go find her, you know. And when I find her, it's like she, just the thought that I'm thinking of her, she is so blessed. I'm blessed at just making her feel good. That's what a marriage becomes eventually. And that's really what a friendship is in a sense. Listen, this is what brotherly love is to each other as well. You get more pleasure out of pleasing someone else, doing for them, blessing them, than you even do thinking of your own needs. Love is patient. Pride is impatient. Love doesn't envy. Pride lives on envy. Love doesn't seek its own. Pride desires gratification, demands constant attention. Love bears all things. Pride is easily offended. See, it's a constant lesson. It's a constant growing process. It is a chore. It's difficult. It's a challenge. It's not easy. That's why he says, let brotherly love continue. Particularly in that society where it was very difficult. So, you're building, not tearing down. You're thinking of positive things to say because the negative things will just come naturally. You're thinking of things that you can do to please them because what you want to do comes naturally. See, what comes naturally is the thing you want to avoid, actually. You want to go against your nature. That's what makes you mature. You train your children good habits as they grow up, responsibility. They don't like those things. Why do I have to clean my room? Why do I have to do those things? Well, it's not about the clean room. It's about developing in them certain disciplines that are going to be very helpful for them later on. As they deny themselves to do whatever they want to do, they're going to become mature, responsible adults. And this is what's missing in our society. There are a lot of men in their 20s and 30s who are still 14. And drugs doesn't help in that regard as well, because that basically puts people in a place where they're not growing anymore. They stop growing from the point they start taking drugs. It's like they're emotionally stagnant. You start when you're 13, take drugs for 20 years. You're 33, you're still 13 emotionally. You got to grow. So here we go. Love. Let brotherly love continue. But he ties into this two more things, verse 2 and 3. Which is going to be the subject here to tie this up. He says, do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Now, I often thought, it seems like one subject jumping to another subject totally. Actually, it's not so. It's an unfortunate English translation. And I don't know why it is entertaining strangers. I mean, when we think of entertaining, we think of Martha Stewart stuff, right? We're going to entertain some guests. So I'm going to entertain strangers instead. You know, do you like the little placemats and how I folded the napkin? And the, you know, that's not what he's saying. That's unfortunate. What the word is, Philadelphia is the word for brotherly love. This word in the Greek, which is translated entertain strangers, sadly enough, is actually philoxenia. That's love for strangers. A friendliness, a kindness, a compassion for those you don't know. You're supposed to have this friendly, kind compassion for your brother. You're also supposed to have that same friendly, kind compassion towards strangers, particularly those that obviously are in need. The idea there is, in doing so, some have unwittingly entertained angels. I'll give you one example of this and how this really does apply. And this makes you different from the world because of what God has done in your heart. You do have a compassion for those in need. Now, we all have a little bit of fear, you know, and trepidation that we might be taken advantage of by some con out there. You're reluctant to help someone who's asking for help. And you should have some reluctance, some understanding, some wisdom and discretion. In fact, in the early church, there were those that took advantage of Christian hospitality. By the way, that word hospitality is translated from the same word, philoxenia, which is love of strangers. That's really what it means. It's showing hospitality is loving those that you don't know. And so people would take advantage of this. They find out you're a Christian and they think you're an easy mark. Oh, I'll get them. I'll manipulate them. I'll get them to feel guilty about not helping me. Hey, aren't you Christians supposed to help people in need? Hey, I'm calling you up and I thought you people were supposed to, I thought you were different. And, you know, they'll throw the manipulation on. Well, you've got to be wise. If you are being manipulated, true love can't be manipulated. When you truly love someone, you want the best for them. You know what's best for a manipulator is not to get their way. So you want that what's best for them. And they might hate you for that because you figured them out. And they're going to throw all the guilt at you, but you know where that's coming from. It just doesn't even affect you because you've been down that road and you learn that, no, you want what's best for that person. You will not be manipulated. In fact, in the early church, certain apostles would come into town, so-called apostles. They had to write this. It was called the Didache. And in fact, in the early church, they had these writings collected by the apostles to warn churches, to give them wisdom to how to recognize a true and a false apostle, a true and a false prophet. And the way that they would actually tell, how they could tell, was a true prophet, a true apostle, would not think of themselves, would only think of someone else. They said, when every apostle who comes to you in the name of the Lord, he says, if he abides more than a single day, or if there be need a second day, if he abides 3 days, he's a false prophet. That is, if he takes advantage of your hospitality and he keeps staying, that he's a false prophet, because he wouldn't do that if he was a true prophet. He wouldn't burden you. He would leave, he'd go somewhere else. Secondly, he says, if he departs and if he takes nothing but bread until he finds shelter, if he asks for money, he's a false prophet. Whoa, that'll categorize quite a few people that use religion to rip people off. I would not want to be in their shoes when they stand before God. Thirdly, in the Didache, he says, and no prophet, when he orders a table in the spirit, shall eat of it. Otherwise, he's a false prophet. In other words, you get this prophet who says, the Lord told us that we should put a big banquet together for everybody. Great. But if he eats of it, you're a false prophet because it's self-serving. See, the whole test was, is it self-serving? So actually, loving strangers is the opposite of self-serving. First of all, what are you going to get out of it? They don't know you. You'll probably never see them again. But there's something wonderful about that care for someone else. You know, when you have an opportunity, sometimes the Lord will just make it very simple for you. This is for you to take care of. Take care of it. I was behind a guy in the gas station and there was a big argument a couple of years ago. I remember the situation. It was a big argument. The guy that got gas, you know, was yelling at the guy who gave the gas. He was yelling and I'm waiting to get gas. So I finally get up to the one spot. They're still dealing with it and I'm filled my tank up and they're still going at it. So I walk up and say, what's the problem? And the guy says, you know, I forgot my wallet and they won't let me go. They won't trust me. And the guy says, well, you know, you got to pay or you're going to, you know, call somebody kind of a thing. And so I said, well, let me pay for it. And I gave him the money for it. And they're like, you know, gas station, no, don't, you don't have to do that. And the guy says, oh, man, I thank you so much. Here's my card. Please. I said, no, don't worry about it. Pass it on to somebody else. And he says, well, can I have your card? So I gave him my card and had an opportunity to say a few things about the Lord. And then I got back in my car and I left. And you know what? It was such a blessing to do that. I got more pleasure out of doing that than I would if someone had done that for me. And I have been in places where actually people have shown that hospitality. Here's the thing. I don't know this guy from Adam. But it was a guy in need. I could see it was a legitimate situation. And as it turned out, he sent me a check for it anyway. I didn't care. But he was so thankful to get out of that situation. Now, this kind of hospitality doesn't come naturally. We have to really train ourselves for this. We have to think. But most of the time, folks, this is the problem. We're thinking about ourselves. We go to the grocery store. We're thinking about what we need. We're not really looking around. We're not observant. We're not watching things around us. Sometimes we're oblivious. Sometimes we see somebody by the side of the road. We just drive by. There's that cautionary aspect. I used to get upset at my wife. You stopped and picked up this guy to help. You don't, what are you doing, honey? Well, I just felt the Lord telling me. I go, how do you argue that? Okay, the Lord was telling you then. I'm not going to argue, but man, makes you nervous in these days. Now, again, there are people that will take advantage of that. The question is, will you be taken advantage of? Will you be ripped off? Will you be hurt sometimes? Yeah, yeah, and yeah. You will. There's risks involved in loving. There's no question about that. But I'd rather take the risk than live unto myself. I'd rather pray, Lord, just you take care of it. If you're pressing me, now I think that the Lord would protect you. If you're driving along and someone stopped by the road and you think, Lord, I'm going to pick this person up or I'm going to help them. I believe if there's a real evil situation there, the Lord will give you a check in your spirit. No. And you just keep driving. I believe he'd protect you. But here's the thing. How far does this go? I'll tell you how far it goes. In 1990, there was a pastor from East Germany. When the walls came down of communism, this pastor who had been under this communist regime and been oppressed horribly by it, the communist dictator, Erich Honecker, was brutal. His wife was even more brutal, and they just kept Christians under. In fact, they did not allow any of this pastor's children to get higher education. They had all kinds of oppressive systems in place for those who still called themselves Christians and wanted to be Christians under that communist regime. It was horrible. When communism fell, this dictator had cancer. He was in the hospital. When he got out, no one wanted him. The communists didn't even want him. No one wanted him. He was a pariah. Communism had fallen. He was a hated man. This pastor took him into his house. And despite all the evil that had been shown, this pastor felt it was his Christian duty to show kindness to someone even that had hurt them in the past. See, this kind of model is really a great testimony to the world that you're different. Anybody can be selfish. That's natural. It comes naturally. But to think of others first, to love, to be compassionate, kind, that takes Christian love. And folks, that doesn't come naturally. That's where you decide to do it long before you feel like doing it. But the challenge is when you decide to do it and you're attacked and you're hit and you decide to do it and you're hit more, you keep doing it, eventually your heart changes until the greatest pleasure is there. And you live. It's a lifestyle. Because what happens is you might just entertain angels unaware. You don't even know. Now, it's not that when you see the example of Abraham and Lot, as they showed hospitality to these strangers, they turned out to be angels. I wouldn't want anybody to be motivated to show hospitality because one day you might hit the lottery. You might hit an angel, kind of a thing. This is just to show you how God prizes hospitality. He wants to give you an opportunity to practice it. It's for your benefit. Open up your life to others. Open up your home to others. There's something sweet that happens in you when you're not worried about yourself. When you open up your home, you're vulnerable. You're vulnerable to what people are going to learn about you. I can learn all I want to learn about a couple, but just by talking to their 4 or 5-year-old, that's all you need to do, really. Those little kids just bubble it out. So what's your dad like when he wakes up? Oh, my daddy, he's really angry, or something. No, they'll just blurt it out. You're going to know everything about a person. I like the one little boy who at the dinner table, when they had some people over, they asked little Johnny to pray. And he says, what am I supposed to pray? And they said, oh, well, just pray what you've learned us talk about. So he says, Lord, good heavens, how on earth am I going to put up with all these people coming to dinner tonight? Little kids will let it fly, right? You know, that's a funny thing about being vulnerable, but in many other ways, when you love strangers, brotherly love, it's a cost to you. But it's a well worth cost, because what happens in your heart is so wonderful as your heart has changed. But then he even steps it up a notch. He goes from brothers to strangers to, verse 3, remember the prisoners as if chained with them, those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. Now, the impression here about the mistreatment is that this is presumably those that are in prison for their faith in the Lord. Not necessarily, however. Because there's a lot of different aspects to this. There can be certainly those that were committed to, you know, prison unjustly. Perhaps in other countries, you know, imprisoned for their faith, as many of our brothers and sisters are in China and other communist countries. Today, even. But this also could imply, you know, there might be some people that have made some mistakes in their lives, done some wrong things, and now are paying for it in incarceration. And as they're incarcerated for their crimes, they've come to the Lord, they've amended their ways, they want to honor the Lord. And it's a very difficult thing. I'll tell you why it's doubly difficult for a Christian in the prisons. Is though they might have the respect of the guards because they're easier to handle, the system will be harder on them, and I'll tell you why. They don't want to give these prisoners any inclination that if they go to the church and they read the Bible and they start doing all these Christian things, that they're going to get out earlier, it's going to be easier on them. So what happens is when a person is an outspoken Christian in the prisons and he goes up for parole, they're more apt to not let him out because they don't want to deal with the politics of showing favoritism to people that were professing Christians. You know what I'm saying? It almost works against them. So by them proclaiming to be Christians and following the Lord, it's actually going to hurt them, not help them in possible parole situations. They're getting socked more than they should. And that's where I believe we as Christians can really make a difference, encourage them. We have great prison ministry. You know, there's ministry to the women in the jails. There's ministry to men. People volunteer going in. There's a number of people volunteering visitations as well as going in providing services. All kinds of opportunities there. And you know what? There is a sense there where really you're showing difference. Especially the difficulty is that's hard on them. You know, when they're incarcerated, it's hard on the family. There's ways that we can bless the families of those that are incarcerated. There's certain limitations you have to put, obviously. If there is a situation where someone's questionable as their Christianity, lying, drugs come into the mix, it really does put a severe limitation on this. You have to be wise. But many prisoners locked away are only going to come out as career criminals if they don't have some hospitality, some Christian love showing them a break, giving them a break, giving them some opportunities. Yeah, we'll be vulnerable. Yeah, we'll be taken advantage of. Yeah, we'll be ripped off from time to time. But you know, the blessings far outweigh those difficulties. To get somebody back on their feet and to see a family come together and the Lord improve their life and encourage them, tremendous. So I really think that in many ways, this is a beautiful picture. Look at the progression. Let brotherly love continue. Don't forget stranger love. Then remember the prisoners. Remember those prison and those suffering who are mistreated. That's a category that's even broader than just those in prison. There's a lot of oppressed people. It blesses my heart to see how in some of these third world countries that really don't have the breaks we as Americans have. A lot of times people say, why are we going over there when we have so many needs over here? We do. But there's a lot of agencies, there's a lot of opportunity here. In some places it's so bad that you can't help but your heart going out to them. And to know what these young people that just got back from the Dominican Republic, how they're impacting that. And the young people that just got back from Mexico. And the young people that have just got back from El Salvador. And these are trips that will be life-changing for not just the people, but also for those that went, because they'll see life totally different. You'll have more compassion on those in need. There's a sense where you forgot about yourself. I tell you, it's the most wonderful thing in the world. Go on a short-term missions trip if you've never done it. It'll change your life. It'll change your life. And it'll give you much more compassion in this area. But let's remember, and don't forget, this doesn't come naturally. This is a chore at first. So go do your chores. Do your chores. Do your duty. Do what's right. Do what you know is right to do, and the Lord will take care of the rest of it. He'll watch over you. Your heart will change. You've been showed great compassion and forgiveness by the Lord God, who sent His only begotten Son to die for you. Now you go ahead and show that same love and mercy and compassion and grace to others around you. That's essentially the big therefore. Since you're receiving this kingdom which cannot be shaken, serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Let brotherly love continue. Let love of strangers, or don't forget or remember, and then remember the prisoners, the oppressed, those that have the least.